This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Sometimes it's kind of amazing this economy works at all, you know? Case in point today, unemployment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. Tuesday today, good as always to have you along, everybody. And if today is the 7th of September, which it is, that means yesterday was the 6th, which means millions of people lost those expanded federal benefits that have been helping drive the economic recovery through the spring and summer. Thing is, the unemployment insurance programs in this country, and I said programs specifically, they are run by the states. We don't have one unemployment system. We have 50 plus districts and territories, too, of course, no offense meant. And most of those systems are a mess. There is a new Unemployment Insurance Modernization Unit at the Department of Labor. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports to get us going, it does have its work cut out for it.
Back in April 2020, New Jersey was in the grips of its first deadly COVID wave and dealing with a surge of unemployment applications. So Governor Phil Murphy made a plea during a press conference.
Not only do we need healthcare workers, but given the legacy systems, we should add COBOL, computer skills.
Actually, he meant COBOL, common business-oriented language, which many state unemployment systems rely on.
COBOL is an old programming language. I think it's had its 50th birthday, so it has more than a few gray hairs.
Martha Coven is a professor of public policy at Princeton who worked on safety net programs in the Obama administration. She says many state systems had been sputtering along for years.
And then when you take an old car and you batch it together enough times, at some point it just collapses on the road.
Many unemployment websites are down during certain hours or don't work on mobile devices, which is how many low-income people access the internet. In some states, workers have to wait to receive a new password by mail to access their accounts. Some states have already revamped their system, says Rebecca Dixon at the National Employment Law Project. But
for example, Florida modernized in a way that they were designed to make it really hard for claimants to navigate the system. So sort of put up roadblocks on purpose.
Dixon says the only way to make sure state systems are easier to use is for the federal government to take the lead. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You know what else could use some rejiggering besides those unemployment systems that Megan was telling us about? Retail supply chains, that's what. Finding the products you need when you need them is really difficult right now. It's also a bit of a nightmare for retailers who are trying to stock up ahead of the holidays. That rush to fill shelves is responsible, in part, for a 15% rise in imports from China just last month. Marketplace's Mario Segarra has more now on what things are like for retail buyers in this moment.
In normal times, retailers do not want to store products for very long. Because when you have a lot of inventory, well, you're tying up your cash. You have to pay for more warehouse space.
Anytime you're storing product, it gets damaged, it gets misplaced.
That's David Marcotte, a senior vice president at Kantar. But he says right now, retailers are ordering whatever they can well in advance.
Because sincerely, they just don't know when and where it's going to show up.
Global supply chains are a mess. You've got shortages of raw materials and computer chips, COVID outbreaks that shut down factories at a moment's notice, and backups at ports. James Zahn at The Toy Book, a trade publication for the toy industry, says cargo ships are just sitting there.
Where some companies might have had 3 weeks of having their product on the water, now it's over a month, and in some cases, 2 months.
So retailers are looking for alternatives, products they know they can get their hands on. The Toy Book just put together a list of toys that are already lying around in U.S. warehouses, puzzles, board games, paint-by-number kits, and can be shipped quickly when a retailer needs something to put on shelves. Chris Considine at the consulting firm Alex Partners says retailers are also looking at what they have and...
You know, marketing the products where you have the deepest inventory. I've been on calls in the last few weeks with clients who are specifically doing that.
In other words, if they have a lot of puzzles, they are going to try their hardest to sell you puzzles. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little up, a little down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Kind of feels like we're back in that place we were in back in March and April of last year. Hospitals and clinics are jammed with COVID patients, and healthcare workers are rightly getting burned out. And it turns out that across the country, a lot of hospitals are losing nurses as the pandemic drags on. Some are just plain walking away. Others are hitting the road to take advantage of the better pay they can get as traveling nurses. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports that the escalating pay is both a product of and partially responsible for the staffing problems in hospitals.
ICU nurses say they have put more bodies in bags than they would have ever expected throughout their careers during the pandemic. And they've also endured the discomfort of donning the gown, gloves, mask, and face shields every day. Some nurses say they deserve better compensation for that tough work.
We work hard, you know, and just weren't seeing the benefits.
Donna Pearson is one of the estimated 2,000 nurses in the state of Mississippi who left a full-time hospital job during the pandemic. Many, as in Pearson's case, have just gone to another hospital as a traveler.
I'm going to follow the money.
The money is crazy, she says. Traveling nurses have always made more than full-time nurses in hospitals and usually get a stipend for meals and lodging. But now it's many times more. Pearson is headed to Midland, Texas, where she'll make more than $120 an hour. How can hospitals afford this? Several southern states, including both Texas and Mississippi, are now using their federal COVID relief money to help hospitals pay the ever-rising hourly rates. But for the hospitals, there are downsides to relying heavily on travelers, mostly morale.
It does take its toll.
Carrie Kroll is a vice president with the Texas Hospital Association, where she says some are offering staff nurses retention bonuses, but it's nothing like the money the same hospitals are paying these temporary nurses who often need some help getting up to speed. And who does that training? The lower paid staff nurse.
When you have nurses that are working on a bedside and they've committed to staying and their colleagues are leaving and are coming and making a lot more of the money than they are. I think it's hard when you're in this environment and you've been dealing with COVID day after day.
It just is infuriating, you know, but they're willing to pay these travelers boo-coo dollars.
Taylor Wiley is an ICU nurse in Nashville who says it seems like the only way to get a pandemic payday is to leave, even though the hospital will likely have to fill the vacancy with a pricey traveler.
I mean, just within the past couple of weeks, we've had so many nurses put in their 2 weeks and go travel because they are going to be making, I've seen contracts for $10,000 to $12,000 a week take home because hospitals are so desperate for staff.
The thing is, there should be enough nurses to go around. Despite fears that the retiring baby boomers would leave a huge hole, the number of nursing graduates has been keeping up with demand each year, says nursing professor Karen Lassiter at the University of Pennsylvania.
And so it's not a nursing shortage. It's a shortage of well-funded positions for nurses.
It's too soon to say if nursing will be forever changed. Professor Joanne Spetz at the University of California, San Francisco, says perhaps more nurses will stay in traveling roles for a while. She says it's more likely that as COVID cools off, hospitals will have to move quickly to training a new crop of fresh nurses.
That really is then shifting this emergency thing into the long-term investment philosophy. And that's really where we're going to have to go.
Either way, Spetz says, the pandemic has proven just how much hospitals have undervalued their nurses, because it's not space that's been in short supply. It's staffing, primarily nurses. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
We're going to get something called the JOLTS report tomorrow, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. It'll be data for July, literally the number of people quitting their jobs. The June report, more than 3.9 million people decided to do something else. And, you know, since the start of the pandemic, we've seen people leaving their jobs for any number of reasons, right? Better paying benefits sometimes, and sometimes also just 'cause. And that is the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Mel Glenn, and I am a mosquito control technician in the Denver area. I'm basically a mosquito hunter. I get my muck boots on, walk out into the cattails, and I take a dipper, which is just a long stick with a cup at the end, and I look for the mosquito larvae in the water. Before, in early 2020, I had been working in a water quality lab, and I decided to leave because during the pandemic, we were told we were essential workers and that I would have to be in the lab with my coworkers and stuff every day, and I didn't feel comfortable being around all those people. Through a friend, I was able to get an interview with this company. I had done a season of mosquito control before, so I knew I had the experience for it. And I knew that I would just be driving around by myself in a truck. And so I thought that would probably be a lot safer. They said, basically, you're hired. They're always looking for people. And not everybody loves stinky swamps like I do. It was a big pay cut, about $7 pay cut from my full-time year-round lab job to a seasonal position. The field season is wrapping up. After that, I don't know. There's no plan yet. I will have to try to find some way to make up at least some of my income. If I find another job in the summer, as summer rolls around, I'll have to quit that job. You know, it doesn't look great on applications or resumes when you're constantly like quitting a job at the same month every year. I just know that this is what I want to do, and I have faith in myself to make it work.
Mel Glenn, out looking for mosquitoes in the Denver area. You know, we cannot do this series without you. So please, let us know how your economy's doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
Yes, I hated it because I thought it was so cynical.
Machiavelli will do that to a person. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 269 today, 0.7%, 35,100. The NASDAQ added 10 points. That's less than a 10%, 15,374. The S&P 500 went the other way, subtracted 15, 0.3%, 45,020. PPG Industries supplies the world with paints and coatings from its home base in Pittsburgh, PA. Its shares scraped off 3.3% today. Shares of Boeing descended 1.8% yesterday. One of its biggest customers, that would be Dublin-based Ryanair, said it had ended talks to buy tens of billions of dollars worth of 737 MAX 10 jets. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how we've been talking about supply chain problems for forever now on this program. Here's another one. Bauxite. You got to have bauxite to get aluminum, and Guinea in West Africa is the world's number two producer of it. There was a military coup in Guinea over the weekend, which goes some way to explaining why aluminum prices hit a 10-year high this week. But aluminum prices have been rising pretty steadily all year. And as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, that's thanks to the other side of the supply equation, demand specifically from the green economy.
Aluminum is everywhere in things we expect, like this can of sparkling water, to things we don't always think about, like buildings, cell phones, solar panels. Demand for aluminum is up for all kinds of green reasons, says Greg Whitbecker with CRU Group.
The aluminum market is going through a host of unprecedented changes.
Aluminum doesn't corrode easily, conducts electricity well, and it's lightweight. That's why there's huge demand for it from automakers that want lighter, fuel-efficient cars.
But also the growing interest in electric vehicles.
For the U.S. and other countries to meet greenhouse gas emissions goals, aluminum is a big player. But making it is not that green.
It's incredibly emission intensive.
Jordy Wilkes heads research at Sukden Financial.
In the smelting process, you use fossil fuels to create that power.
A lot of aluminum is produced in China and traditionally relied on coal. Still, more aluminum production overall is now using green energy. Halvor Mulland with Hydro in Norway uses hydropower to produce aluminum.
We can't really get enough of that material to our customers.
Companies want green aluminum to show they're green too.
The end consumers are asking for low carbon products.
Including recycled aluminum, which can be recycled over and over again. And you don't need a smelter to do it. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
I did something last week that I haven't done in all the time I have been working on this program, an interview with an old friend and a former colleague of mine.
Kai! Oh my God, it is really nice to hear your voice.
It is nice to hear you too. Stacey Vanek Smith is now the host of NPR's podcast, The Indicator. But before that, she was a reporter here at Marketplace. And before that, she was the overnight producer for me when I hosted the Marketplace Morning Report.
We build character. We still found time to do the Wall Street Journal crossword.
That's right. That's right. She was always better at it than I was. Anyway, after we caught up, as colleagues tend to do, we got around to the new book she has written. It's called Machiavelli for Women. Yes, that Machiavelli, the prince, ends justify the means, that guy. It's about how his words are relevant to women in the workforce today. So here you go. Hey, you wrote a book.
Yes, I did. I did write a book.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm very, very thrilled to be here talking with you about it, Kai.
You are not as thrilled as I am. It is great to have you. I'm going to say back at Marketplace for a little bit.
Yeah, well, 11 years.
I know. All right, but let's get to it here, shall we? And here, I'm a big one for introductions and epilogues in books, as you may remember. And here's what I want to do. I want to start literally at the very beginning of this book, where you say you read the Prince in college and you hated it. Yet here we are.
Yeah. Well, experience is a funny thing, Kai. So, yes, I hated it because I thought it was so cynical. You know, it was all obsessed with taking power from other people and sort of scheming. And I was much more idealistic. I liked Cicero and Marx and, you know, kind of the more like people are noble and they just need to find the very best in themselves and will create like a network of brother and sisterhood all across the world. But then, you know, I worked.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to notice that things that happen in the workplace are not necessarily fair or inspiring or make you think of like networks of brother and sisterhoods across the world. I just found myself thinking about Machiavelli. So I thought it was a good proxy for women in the workplace and for other marginalized workers.
A lot of this book is you and your personal experiences. And here's where I have to refer back to the disclaimer I made in the introduction. I was around, I mean, you and I worked together on the overnights for a long time. You were at Marketplace for a while, and we've known each other for a while. I was around for some of the incidents you describe.
Yeah.
And it's interesting and troubling to me that the first experiences you had with this discrimination and challenges in the workplace happened in public radio, you know?
Well, what I would say to that is thank you. But these are the things that happen in all the workplaces all across the country. It was by no means unique. And I mean, it's especially notable because I think we work with a really great, smart, well-intentioned group of people. I mean, I think it just speaks to the fact that this is just what happens. You know, 80% of CEOs are men. The pay gap, which is women earn about 80 cents on the dollar. For Black women, it's 63 cents. For Latina and Native women, it's 55 cents. This is the culture that we're in. This is the world that we're in.
Yeah. You have distilled your reporting for this book with regular women in the workplace and women of some renown, great renown in point of fact, and you offer guidance and advice, right? But you also say a couple of times, look, it's really hard for me to give you this advice because X, Y, and Z, and the petard that you get hoisted on there is the systemic solution, right? Because this is a systemic problem. The systemic solution is not always in line with what individuals have to do for their own day-to-day.
Well, this is really true. So one of the reasons that I wrote the book was that I felt like a lot of the research I was reading and the books I was reading and the data I was reading kind of dealt with, here's what companies should do. And what kept coming into my mind, and I think what drew me to Machiavelli, was like, but they're not. Like, what do you do if a company isn't doing that? Or what do you do if a company is doing that, but it's just not happening fast enough? It just felt like all the power was given to institutions and policies. And certainly those are the things that will really move the needle. But I wanted advice that I could give people on an individual level. Like, what power do you have in a situation? What options do you have in a situation? Because it's so easy to feel really powerless in a lot of these situations. And you're so right. Some of the advice I give was, like, really disturbing, right? I mean, it's not like, did I feel great saying, like, if you smile in a negotiation, the negotiation's more likely to go well. You know, you should consider not being so assertive or demanding in a negotiation or people won't like you.
That must have just killed you to have to write that, right? I mean, it's true, right? But it's just a societal bias that just must make your head explode as you're sitting there saying, I'm going to write this in a book now.
No, it's true. It did not make me feel good to write to write that advice. But the thing that makes Machiavelli both timeless and honestly a little chilling in certain moments is that he kind of tries to remove emotion and morality from his advice. It's very practical. It's sort of like, look at the situation and make decisions about how to best get what you want in a situation. And does this mean you have to smile in a negotiation? Of course not. But at least you have that piece of knowledge.
Okay, so the last, 8, 10, 12 pages of this book is, and I'm not at all surprised coming from you and knowing you, right? It's almost literary, right? You talk about drinking wine from his vineyard and sitting on your stoop in the middle of the pandemic watching.
My research drinking.
That's right.
That was my research drinking.
But here's what I want to know. What do you suppose he would make, as you say in this book, what do you suppose Machiavelli would make of an entire section of the society across space and time looking to him for lessons?
I think he would be very thrilled, honestly. Machiavelli wrote this book. It was basically a cover letter. He was trying to get his job back. He was essentially the Secretary of State for Florence. Florence got taken over by the Medici family, and he wrote the prince to try to get his job back. He was like, this is all the wisdom that I have for my job. And he was hoping to sort of blow the Medici socks off. It did not work. I don't think Medici ever read it. The Catholic Church did read it and then threatened to excommunicate anyone who owned the book. They were totally horrified. And he died thinking that it was, I think, a failure. I have a lot of affection for Machiavelli after spending all these years with him. I think he would be interested at how little certain things had changed and how applicable I think a lot of his lessons are. I mean, it's still true in its own way 500 years later.
It is a book called Machiavelli for Women. Stacey Vanek Smith wrote it. You hear her on The Indicator on NPR. It's a podcast. You used to hear her here, which kind of makes me sad that you don't anymore, but that's okay. Congratulations on the book. It's really good to talk to you.
Thank you, Kai. It's great to talk with you.
This final note on the way out today, in which El Salvador has a rough day in the currency markets. Bitcoin became legal tender in El Salvador today, as you might have heard. And as Molly Wood said to me on our podcast, Make Me Smart this afternoon, it is early days yet to know whether this is going to turn out to have been a smart move or not for El Salvador. Short term, anyway, though, it looks dicey. Bitcoin down about 9% as of right now. Of course, that is an opportunity too. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, tweeted this today. He said, buying the dip. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context with that JOLTS report that's coming tomorrow morning in mind. This tidbit from the New York Fed, their monthly labor market survey, what is called the reservation wage, the lowest wage that people would take for a new job. $68,954 in July this year. The record, a bit more than $71,000 was hit this March. Siobhan Brett, Ufuk Mevatolu, Janet Wynn, and Donna Tam are part of the digital and on-demand team around here. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.